The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do, the podcast where I, your host, Dead Air Dennis Maller, interviews artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And the artist and entertainer that we're talking to on the show today is Alex the Jester, Alex Feldman. Alex Feldman is a clown, like a real clown. He's a friend of mine here in the Boston area. He lives in Summerhill. He performs all around the country, all around the world as a silent theatrical clown. Now, we've had other clowns on the program, and every time we talk to somebody, their clown experience is different, and that's what I like. Alex is like the true, like, original European style, like, theatrical jester, medieval jester, clown type. His show is very brilliant, and it's very different, it's very alternative, and I absolutely love it. I met him here in Boston doing shows at the Comedy Studio. I helped him out, run tech for a clown show he was producing at the Rockwell. Maybe back then it was called the Davis Square Theater, in Summerville. And it's such a amazing, true art form to watch the theatrical clowns, like, you know, the dramatization and the character work. And he's an amazingly talented performer in general, of juggling, unicycles, magic tricks. And then he does all of this pretty much silent. He'll talk about how it's not so silent now, but it kind of is silent, but it's kind of not. It's fantastic. You should check it out. By the way, I am wearing my new headphones. If you follow me on the social medias, you'll know that I've got myself a new pair of my favorite headphones, the Sony MDR7506s, which are just like, they are the status symbol of radio gear. Like for me growing up, like the two things working in radio, the two things that were status symbols that I love, that was like, I'm a real professional, are these headphones, which, by the way, not a sponsor of it, but Sony, if you want to sponsor me for headphones, please, please. I bought a brand new pair. Which, by the way, I'm not doing freelance work. I'm not going out in the field and working anymore. I don't need a pair for home and a pair for the road. So why did I spend money on these expensive headphones? Well, I got a deal on them, but also I just wanted them. And I bought new ear cups for my old pair too. But yeah, I'm geeking on the tech to you. But yeah, the other status symbol was owning a Porta-Brace bag for your gear. Like a gear, like Porta-Brace just makes just an iconic gear bag, and they have so many different specific bags for like cameras and specific audio equipment. And I had one when I worked for the radio stations in Washington, D.C. when I was an engineer doing remote broadcasts. And I carried this thing to every event. And every time I pulled it out of the trunk of my car, this bag was, look out, here comes the audio, the real audio guy. And then when I moved to Boston, I had to give up my bag because it's the company's bag, not mine. And then a couple years ago, I found a really good deal for one in great condition on eBay. And the U.S. Post Office, who delivered it to the wrong address. And it was taken, and it disappeared. It became this huge fight between me and the post office. I mean, it was ugly. I got ugly. I looked up people's houses and their address and threatened them. I was like, they refused to honor. They refused to admit their mistake. I had a friend who worked for the post office, and he looked up the thing for me. The GPS coordinates was 500 feet away from my home. I told them exactly where they left it. And I was like, you delivered it to the wrong place. Like, no, we didn't. Like, but you did. And all I wanted was this bag. And like, and then they refused to honor the insurance on it because it wasn't scanned in to the facility in Kentucky properly. Like, do you think I drove all the way to Kentucky, broke into your facility, dropped it off in line, walked away with my hands ringing, oh, it's the perfect crime. Nobody will ever know. To have it mailed back to myself? Like, no, we don't think you did that at all. I was like, well, then you owe me the money for this bag. And I gave up on the argument. It was too emotionally draining for me. The rage that I felt was frightening. And I found another one on eBay a short time later. It wasn't mint condition. It wasn't the one in the picture. It was tattered and torn. The zippers were broke. And I came to the realization a couple weeks ago that I might just give up this bag. Because I might not use this bag ever again. I'm pretty much done with the audio industry. Freelance. I think I am. I hope I am. I love my job at Boston Duck Tours. And I'm not going to say this is the end game. But while living in Boston, I don't want to have another job. I want to keep this one. I want them to keep me. I want to keep coming back. I want this team. This is my outro plan. I'm not going to stay here the rest of my life. I have no interest in that. But this is that job that can get me to that point where I can move away from here comfortably. This can set me up with the plan that I've been wanting to enact for years of moving to LA and trying to do more entertainment. And that's not why I want the job, because it is the plan. It's because I love it as much as I do. And it's a weird thing to come to grips with, that all I've wanted my entire life was being an audio guy, being a tech guy, being an entertainer, but also I loved working the tech side of stuff. And I don't want to do the tech stuff anymore. You know, I did it for a long time and I had fun. I loved it and I still love that. But I'm feeling that I'm done with it. I don't think I'll never not do another event. I already booked a freelance gig, a recording gig. I'm already doing the Goodfellas or the Godfather. Every time I think about it, they pull me back in. I'm looking at the equipment I have and I have no gear acquisition syndrome anymore. I will look at reviews of gear and then I turn them off. I'm like, I don't care about this piece of equipment. Buying those headphones was nice. That's what I wanted to do. That might have been more depression based than it is gear acquisition syndrome, but GAS, gas. Yeah, I got gas. Look at me. Of course I have gas. But it's a weird thing making such a humongous change in my lifestyle and in my work. You know, I often joke, the reason I have this podcast at all is just so I had the reason to build a studio and tinker with the studio. And I still might tinker. I have plans. I know I've said, I think last year I had plans on changing this studio, and a year later didn't change anything. We'll see next year. We'll see how it goes. Some days I think about giving up the podcast just because, do I move on from that yet? But not today. Today we're not moving on. Today we have an amazing, a very fun story. I'm going to admit, Alex, sorry I'm going to say this, but you are so hard to wrangle down and have a conversation with. You're just all over the place. You're asking me questions. It's like, whoa, I'm not the subject. You're the subject. Stop asking me questions about me and my life. That's what Stephen K came in for a couple years back, is to ask finally me about me and myself. But it was great having Alex on the podcast to talk about getting into the world of theatrical clowning and talk about busking on the streets and the stigma that it creates. And it's a really good, fun, interesting story. And it's going to, I hope, if you're not as familiar with clowning as obviously Alex is, but I mean, as familiar with I am as it being a theatrical art, I hope it opens your eyes to the sheer talent that theatrical clowning takes. So please enjoy my conversation with clown and comedian Alex the Jester. So that's what I wonder. You are somebody who has performed internationally, and you're now visiting another country with your family. Do you find it necessary to have to perform to give reasoning for the travel still?
Because I want to say no, but the answer is yes.
Is your family at least, you know, like, Dad, don't go performing?
Well, I don't need to perform as much as some of my peers. But in daily life, my boys will remind me that they can't walk two blocks with me without me talking to somebody. And as I wake up to live another day, it's often listening to somebody, just engaging. I just really enjoy that. And particularly when I'm in another country, all my senses are aware. And the part of me that might have been an anthropology major if I had not dropped out of college just loves interacting with people from other countries. So I kind of like to drop hints that I'm not just a tourist. And I admit it, because part of me thinks, like, if you were egoless, but let's face it, solo performers, you have to have at least some kind of ego if you're going to say, everyone, stop what you're doing, listen to me, and laugh when I want you to laugh, and not when I don't want you to. So, yeah, so my kids will notice it, but I think anyway, I told you my piece. Tell me about you. You're saying that, yeah, when you're, you might feel a little like something's missing in a strange town and you're not doing a gig.
My problem is that I need the justification for the vacation. I'm a workaholic, even when it comes to doing comedy. So it's like when I go to the reason I'm going to vacation is so I can do comedy. Like the one time I had a chance to go out and just go out for a complete and total holiday trip. You know, a vacation, my sister, her kids, her in-laws, and my mother all went to Disney World for a week. And it all coincided with, like, I lost my job. I got a big, you know, severance from them. I had the disposable income and the time off. And I was like, all right, yeah, I can take this trip. But I still booked comedy gigs, not seven nights of comedy.
Well, you want to write off your travel on the taxes.
Right. I wish I was making enough money as a comedian to financially afford,
all right,
financially be able to viably get away with that with the IRS.
I was forgetting how I had been for a lot of years, which was, it's consuming to keep the gigs coming, and it's hard to justify just traveling without. And here's the other thing too. There are certainly times when I really needed money, and it just always felt nice to come home with more than I left with, and felt bad to come home with less than I left with. I'm a little lucky that I had a kind of gig that I could make money. I mean, there's some people more talented, but they're just in, like, if you're doing spoken word or something, you're going to be happy to come home and break even.
That's also like this year, I specifically, because I work for Boston Duck Tours now, so I meet a lot of people from around, not just the country, but around the world. And I talk to a lot of guests. And I've been trying to, when I talk to the guests, relate to their location with something that I've done. Like, oh, I went to blank city, or I know somebody from blank city or state or whatever. And I realized I didn't have a lot to talk about Chicago. Not that I'm such a worldly traveler, but Chicago people come to Boston a lot for vacation, and they come on my tours a lot. And I didn't really have a relatable thing to say about Chicago other than I had a layover in O'Hare. So I decided to book a trip randomly to Chicago. Got the disposable money. Take I have three days off from work. If I book this, you know, in advance enough, it's cheap. And I did it. And I went out there and I booked three nights of comedy. I was out there for, you know, four days, three nights, whatever it was, you know, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and, you know, fly home Tuesday. So two nights. And I booked the gigs because I'm like, I'm going here for two reasons. One, to be a tourist, to do tourist things. Two, to do comedy. And
it's not necessarily in that order, even though your express purpose was to learn about Chicago.
But unfortunately, Mike, it was to develop some kind of thing about Chicago.
Oh, okay.
Like, I wanted to have a Chicago experience to relate to people about. And unfortunately, like, both the comedy gigs fell through. Like, you know, when the shows got canceled because no audience showed up. One of the things was an open mic, and I didn't realize it was a random open mic, and they draw a bucket, and like, it's got a hard out, and I didn't get picked, and I literally walked away from it furious, thinking that I wasted my trip to Chicago because I didn't end up doing comedy when that was the point of coming out. I was like, no, the point was coming out here was to have an experience in Chicago. You took a really great boat tour. You got to try deep dip, you know, Chicago style pizza. You saw the Lincoln Monument that you talk about on your tour because you have a trivia fact about it, but you have never actually seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to like reconcile with myself that like I didn't fail my trip because I didn't do comedy. I succeeded in my trip in that I made the trip and I did it.
That's a great advertisement for why it's worth framing and reframing the way we look at things. You reframed it.
Yeah. So it's like, as other performers, like someone like you, you know, which, well, let's start with your background, because I'm being very vague about it. And I have a lot of comedians on here, and I'm not going to say you're not a comedian, but you're a specific person in the world of comedy in that you're a clown. And you're not the first clown
in most countries
that we've had on the show.
I am proud to be a clown. This country, we think of birthday parties, balloons. Hello, boys and girls. And that dogs me. And I wouldn't be able to do the stage work I do if I use that moniker. But yes, I am a theater clown. And how many theater clowns do Americans get to see? Not a whole lot. There's probably more United States senators, you know, than there are, you know, theater clowns. But there's a few, you know. Well, and
well, the question is, who is more dangerous to the people, the clowns or the senators?
Yes, and when they call that 45 a clown, the orange cheek, I'm like, no, please don't insult. You know it.
Don't give the clowns a bad name.
It does. Yeah.
So let's start with that, because I find it interesting, the people that I've had on that have experience with clowning, clown college, performing and that stuff. Everyone has a different way that they got into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of my previous guests, who was a high school friend of mine, got into clown college because our theater teacher went, hey, you would probably be good at this. Why don't you go to the audition? You know, Steve-O from Jackass has been on the program and is also famously well known for going to the Ringling Brothers clown
college. They probably have both told you it's easier to get into what school? Harvard Medical
Clown College. Yeah, Harvard Medical School than it is to get into clown college. Yeah. So for them, like, and then my most recent guest who is a clown and entrepreneur, Bree Crabtree, she got into it because she wanted to do magic and juggling as a kid and kept it as a secret and then turned that into a children's entertainment career. Mm-hmm. For you, what made you want to be into clowning? Because there's a good path for your two boys who are becoming of adult age now.
Yep.
They juggle, they do unicycles. You've taught them the art of a lot of clowning stuff. You guys do a lot of practicing and rehearsing together. Was there somebody in your youth that showed you the art of clowning that made you want to fall into that sphere?
Well, I think my father, maybe. He wasn't a performer at all, but he was drawn to dangerous things. And like, as a party trick, he would take a big carving knife and just flip it one turn and catch it on the handle and catch it. And that most people won't want to do that at a party. I mean, would you want to take a sharp knife? And just, it's only one flip. And then he once showed me, God, this is cracking me up because I admire how he didn't mind telling me when I was a little boy. He showed me a little stain near the thermostat. It was like a little faded red stain. And he said, last night, I had some friends over and I tried to do two flips. And the point hit my index finger and just a little spout of blood, not much, but very strong squirt, hit the wall. And I'm laughing thinking about it now, because now that I'm a dad, I'm not so sure I'd be as... I mean, this is like decades ago. Isn't that showing vulnerability? You're telling your own kid, But then this is also reminding me of, like, so I think I got some of that interest in, you know, drying stunts, but I got, he was very distractible, and I think he loved doing stunts, but just didn't have the focus to put the hours that it takes to, like, especially when you're throwing sharp knives. And I did it when I was young. I've long ago given up all that stuff, but you gotta, like, nail it. In fact, this is why, if you want to juggle something dangerous dead air, start with fire torches. They look just as impressive. If you catch a fire torch on the wrong side for just a second, you let go. Look at your hand. It's got some black, like, smoke. It's dirty. But if you catch a knife for just a half a second on the wrong side,
that leaves a little more permanent mark.
So it took me a while to, like, I thought I was a lot smarter than him because I didn't catch the knife on the wrong side. I taped up my knives with cardboard master. By the way, he was doing one. I did fucking three. You know what? This is my first year performing, by the way. And like I say, I'd be embarrassed if I saw videos of this. Because also to work theaters as a stage clown, you don't even want to do anything that looks like a street act. Knives are, and torches is what they do to draw crowds. And they won't hire you because there's a huge prejudice against them. So, but back to risk-taking. I went up I was playing wall ball with our boys, and they whipped a rubber ball against the Brown School here in Somerville, and it went up to the roof. The ball got stuck there, and I was pleased that I was going to say, hey, boys, I'll get that for you. We're not going to give up on the ball. I'm thinking it's like a dad lesson, you know, don't waste money. So I climb up the whole brick wall. It's a three-story building. There's one little part I had to stretch a bit, but I was able to stretch. I got up there, got the ball. I found two other balls. So I threw our ball. I've got two more. I figured I might have had like $5 worth of balls. And but climbing down was... It's different. The part that I stretched up for, lowering myself down, I couldn't see my feet. I was like scared that I was going to, so I'm pausing because I'm still the dad. I got to I didn't want to break my leg in front of them. That would be bad. But then as I'm pondering my move,
yeah, I would say,
I realize it's broad daylight. I'm on the side of a school right next to Willow Ave, which is a well-trafficked street. I'm going, this isn't good because now, you know, I could be arrested for climbing, breaking it. I mean, I'm like a cat burglar clinging to like a wall in a school after hours. So I'm going, I better hurry up, but not break my, anyway, the whole point is I had these two risks, but I saved $5. And that was the kind of risks I don't want to take because that's called a small, you save by $5, but you could either break your leg or get arrested in front of your kids. Both bad options. But here's the kind of risk that's so worth taking. Is like you're in an airport and you see somebody interesting at like the newsstand. You know, it might be someone, you're a people person, Dennis. You can feel when someone's a cool character. They'll hire you, or maybe they'll invest in your company. Or if you're single, maybe they're attractive or whatever. If you go up and say hi to them and strike up a conversation, they might look at you like, "Who are you?" That's the down risk. The up risk is you might get a job or an investor or fall in love. So those are the risks to take with the big upside and the small downside. Not climbing buildings to get rubber balls.
See, you know, as somebody who grew up as a rock climber and rock climb instructor, climbing up a wall, even as somebody who is experienced without safety nets, does sound terrifying. On the other hand, walking up to a stranger and talking to them is not terrifying at all for me. And that's probably why I'm a stand-up comedian and you're a clown.
Yeah.
You'll take the physical risks. I'm willing to take the emotional one because if I go talk to a pretty woman at the airport and she doesn't like me, I was going to go home and cry anyway. I just now have a reason for it.
Well, then it sounds like that. Yeah. I mean, you might have some advice. Like, there's not this, I, you know, what is it? This these pickup artists, and they talk about how you just got to get 100 rejections and not care about it. There's, I'm like, what? I mean, it doesn't matter to me now, but back then I'm going, oh, they have a whole way of take risks. Those are small risks. And it's not the pickup artist. It sounds kind of a seedy scene, but women need the same.
Oh, it is very seedy. Yeah. Those guys, those are not the people that we should be learning from, because their mastery is built in the art of oppression and taking advantage of people. But
well, I do think we can learn from things everybody. The ends aren't very attractive to me, because it's short. It's like snacking as opposed to like healthy eating, you know, and they're often hurting people too, because they're not serious about, but well, whatever, they're all different. But the point is, like, the way I was reading it, an author on it who wrote about it, Neil Strauss, maybe, he became a more, someone who went after what he wanted from learning how to just approach people. I think it might be very easy to dismiss you because you are such a people person, Dennis, that it probably hasn't been a problem. I mean, I could be wrong, though. There are some comedians who look like they're the life of the party. I mean, like, I was at a party with you recently, and you schmooze, like, effortlessly. But were you always like that?
Had that personality on stage, but don't have that personality off stage. Yeah,
lots of us do. I'm probably a little more like that. What about you?
No, yeah, I'm on... The person you see on stage is the guy that's off stage.
And
that's why I get on stage, because if I wasn't on that stage, I'd be doing the same thing at parties or to the cashier at the grocery store.
Right, right. And I think you're most resemble what people expect when they meet a comedian. But as you know, from interviewing so many of them, I mean, half of them are like, should I put the nose pick first, then pull the earbuds off? And they were sort of pull the earbuds off and then do the nose pick. And it's very analytical. It's construction. And I understand that, but you're more like what people expect, which is just you're not that different off stage.
Yeah. So, but for you, what, as a young person, like watching your father juggle a knife at home for funsies, made you want to get into the art of clowning? Because you didn't go to clown college. You went to, you know, the International School of Physical Theater.
But I actually started a real college before that, and I was not thriving. And I went to this club that had, it was a juggling club. I was more drawn to the unicycles. And I suddenly found something way more interested than reading anthropological case studies. Actually, reading them was okay, but having to write the friggin' papers... the deadline, the stress, and also having to sit down so long. And so anyway, I got into juggling a little bit, but I really got into unicycling. And then I found how fun it was to unicycle into malls. And the security did not like that. And they would chase me out. And they say, you can't ride that in there. And I'd say, I am riding it in here. Well, you can't. I'm just doing it. Well, get the fuck out. And then,
look, I did a lot of practice to show you that I can, in fact, do that.
Yeah. It drew me to a world of mischief, where that might be the little strand of comedy that's always been in me. It was mischief. But I wasn't witty or anything. But the point is, I just got into that. And then I met someone who went to the Del Arte School of Physical Theater. And I said to my folks, I think I'm going to go to this. They said, what? This just looks like a clown school. And I said, no, it's a Del Arte School of Physical Theater. But whatever. They weren't taking it. And they were quite worried when I dropped out, and I was naive, and I think naivety helped me. I think naivety helped me because I was like, I didn't know it would be a hard road to do. I just like, I knew nothing else, and you know, that was the end of my college career. I promised him I was going to go back. I didn't swear on the Bible, but I said, I need to just sort myself out with a year off. But man, that suddenly what was missing at college was a sense of purpose, and I found it there. So I went to San Francisco and tried, I did a lot of bad shows. Best to do bad shows somewhere else, and then you come to the city that you want to live in, you know, a little bit more fully formed.
What was the curriculum for Del Arte International School? What was the curriculum like? Because is because I talk about this with other people, and some people don't realize that, you know, we talked about it earlier that we see clowns as like, oh, face makeup and goofy animal, balloon animals, wonk, wonk.
Yeah.
But there is a very real serious art to it.
Yes.
And then you think about the amount of like skills that one has to obtain to do to be a clown. You know, there's
Let me say the skills are a shortcut to being able to make some money. But you can be a great clown without the skills. The hardest part, and this will really help anyone trying to do anything like visual in front of audiences, is having a character. And I'm still, after all these years, I take things out of the act if they don't fit the character. And I'm still learning my own act. And that's why I learned that if there was one takeaway from Del Arte, it was to, people don't care as much what you do on stage. They care more who you are, and to sort of know who you are and not just make fun of anything that moves. I mean, there's actually some comedians who've made a lot of money by not having any real sense of, you know, strong sense of what they would put in their act and what they wouldn't. But the ones that I'm really drawn to, that I really love, like you watch Robin Williams as he grew in his career. There are things he believed in, you know? And I don't want to go off that track, but the comedy I like is when there's a premise, and the comic stands for something.
It's interesting. There are so many of these things. When you look at the different disciplines of comedy, there's a lot of similarities in theories, but not the same verbiage. Like what you're talking about the character work of, you know, staying within the realm that is your clown character. Whereas in stand-up, we call that our voice, you know? That my jokes are in my voice, which is what my perspective is.
Improv,
they call that the art of they call that the rules of the game. You know, like when you're doing an improv scene with other people, what's the game here in this scene? And it's so interesting to hear the different terminology of things that are very similar. Because like I said, what you're describing to me sounds very much like what I describe as being my voice as a comedian. Mm. And talking about character work, I was literally just talking about this today with one of my trainers at Boston Duck Tours, is that I've been working really hard on creating my character at Boston Duck Tours to be a, what I gleaned from a comedy writer for The Simpsons, who's doing like whole great a series of TikToks about the background scenes of writing and like the analyticalness of writing comedy. And one of the things he brought up was a Michael Scott character, like Michael Scott from The Office, where he's this incredibly sympathetic comedic character that is relatable, but is so arrogantly imbecilic. It's what endears you to him. His hubris is so large, but his intelligence is so small. And I've been trying to develop that. And we had to go through, my trainer and I sat on a 2.5 hour phone call earlier today. I might as well have recorded another podcast with him over the phone.
Your third of the day, right?
My third podcast of the day, my third, 2 hour conversation talking about comedy. And we had to go through some of my jokes and my bits and my history stuff. You know, my duck tour is not a comedy tour. It's a history tour with a close to unhealthy amount of comedy.
You have an infinite amount of things you could draw from, and to do it in the voice that's true to you, you want to make that into a very small percentage.
Yeah. And he was talking about one of my jokes doesn't land in this way that I expected it to. And that this is the punchline that becomes that sympathetic. Like this is aggressive and comes off bitter, whereas this punchline is more in the line of that sympathetic idiot that you're trying to create. And I had to go, yeah, you're right, Plucky. That is more in the style of the character that I am creating.
And then have you taken away a big laugh or a really funny part because it doesn't fit? I mean, that's wicked hot.
That's what the conversation was today, is there are certain things that I need to tweak that would hopefully get a bigger laugh, would hopefully be in the vein of what I'm trying to accomplish while still staying in the guidelines of the company. So, you know, just like stand-up is always trial and error and always continuously changing.
Right, right.
It's and evolving. This history tour is also going to be evolving as well. And these are things that I'm going to have to adjust and try out. And, you know, especially since I've been doing, you know, I did 550 some tours this year.
Wow. That must be
550
pretty...
right now. I'm at 550, almost 560, 80 minutes.
You could have a terrorist climb onto your duck boat and you'd be able to smoothly segue when you've done 550. I actually love right? that. I love it when you know it so well that you can really deviate and talk the terrorist dropping his weapon without ever letting the tourists from Chicago know that a crisis was happening because you kept everything calm. You could not do that on your first week of a duck tour, but 550 shows, there's something beautiful about that. And I think that's a creative act. When you've done something so many times and you've been assuming you're present every time, some people just get robotic.
Autopilot.
But that's not you.
Yeah. Yeah. I did 440 tours yesterday, last year, my first season, not counting practice tours, like actual tours for humans. And 560 this year. So I'm at 1,000 tours right now. And there is a staleness that I can feel that I still have to try and keep fresh, but also at the same time, I have to, you know, let it evolve and grow. And it's very much different than doing an act on stage, because when you come to a comedy club, you're expecting a show. When you sit on a duck boat, you're not expecting as much of a show as I'm giving you.
Oh, so it sounds like there really isn't so much pressure.
There is. The pressure is, it's different pressure.
Oh.
It's different pressure. I guess, and similar in the way, like, the pressure is different between, like, performing on a theater stage as opposed to, like, busking on the street performing.
Well, that has, those are very different pressures, but they both have plenty of pressure. So what's the pressure of giving the tour, like, give an example of when you're going, oh, shit. And not,
well, the
because,
tour is,
not because there's a flat tire or a terrorist on board, but, like.
Well, the big problem is if you have 34 people on the duck boat, that's not ready for a comedy show. They don't want to laugh. They don't want to be entertained. They don't know why they're there. They, like, I say the company sometimes.
But you might be in your mind bombing, but they don't know you're bombing because they're
right.
So that doesn't sound like that awful. That sounds okay.
It's still emotionally hurtful.
Oh, right. Because you know how good it could be. You know what? I would only think it's emotionally hurtful if one of your fellow duck boat operators or one of the comedians from the comedy studio walked onto the. That's when I would feel the stress. But if no one you know's on there, you know, you're like, in fact, you're probably making one person smirk, and that one person smirking is going, nobody gets this. This guy did this.
Those say, oh, I've had that after the tour where people come off as like, I loved it, but the rest of them were wrong.
By the way, I have a little trapeze bar, which I just helps.
Oh,
me.
I love it. We're literally hanging out together.
We're hanging out. Yeah, I think I have an internal clock. Remember there were some studies a few years ago about how sitting was like the new smoking?
Yeah.
I kind of celebrated that because I used to sit obediently.
I was literally sitting down reading that article and smoking a cigarette.
I've often sat obediently, like in school, and then now I don't have a lot of meetings in my life, but they happen now and then. And now, if I'm ever at a meeting, I just announce, I'm going to get up in a few minutes, and I might get behind the chair like this, and it's not because I'm bored or I have to piss or something. You know, it's like
it's you. Yeah, you have. Like, I don't sit still well either. Like when I worked in radio, like the fact that I sit and be able to do my podcast is a new thing for me, because in radio I stood up and I talked and I moved around the camp. I moved my microphone around and I talked and I stood and I danced around the studio talking, doing my radio shows and stuff like that. And even on my tour, I've been reprimanded. Part of that 2-hour talk was like, sit in the chair while the duck boat is moving.
Oh, I see. Cause the suits don't want to see you unexpected stuff. Cause also you're not even driving.
No, thank God.
That's one of the few reasons why they should make the two job, driver and tour guide, which are two jobs, back to one job, because then you could dance around because you have the power to brake or not brake. But when the other guys get the power,
you can
brake and give you a face plant. Boom.
Just stopping in the middle of Comm Ave to turn around and play a ukulele song and then get back in the driver's seat. That's not going to fly.
Have you ever had a driver mess? Because you're not the driver usually, right? You're usually the...
No, never. You'll never see me behind the wheel.
So, like, you get... This looks like the fun part.
And oh, if yeah. You're, that's why I'm
if
there.
If you're, like, feeling grooving and people are looking at you like, oh, that guy's funny. I want to go home and have a beer with him. He could just, like, tap the brake out of resentment, you know? Just a little harder.
That is a problem at the job, but... So let's talk about the Del Arte, because I had to go through 2 months of training of history and comedy to be able to do this for you at a professional college for the performing arts. What was you immediately started feeling at home and that you now had a purpose? Was there an immediate vision of this is what I want to do with my life? Or was this still, oh, I feel fulfilled and purposeful, but I still have to figure out what I'm going to do for a job and a living.
I haven't really thought about that, but it's just hitting me that, first of all, I didn't overnight have a switch, and it was a 1-year-long program. And what's hitting me is that I think when I was 20 or something, I didn't have any feelings whatsoever, or at least I didn't know I had feelings. I was a man who, even though, you know, my parents were pretty cool about, you know, they didn't think I had to be all, you know, like the old style silent macho man. I still didn't know that I was lonely. I was lonely there because most of the students came from Sweden and Denmark,
really?
And the Scandinavian countries, which had scholarships. I had to work in a cannery in Alaska to make enough money. And I kind of ran out toward the end of the year. So I was kind of lonely. I don't think it was till I got out of school and I'm like, now what? And then I started busking in San Francisco, and then I came to Boston, and all of a sudden, I was so busy just trying to survive. It seemed interesting, and that's when the change happened. I'm like, wow, this is combining a lot of things I love, which is moving and connecting with people and trial and error. And I've always loved working. I have not liked being a student in the school setting. Nothing against formal learning. I'm really proud. Our boys have done well. They've done way beyond what I did. I encouraged them. They didn't want to juggle unicycle, clown, and be, well, actually, they're both frigging good musicians. I'm so proud of them. But the point is they also have other skills that are more marketable than I had. Anthropology.
That are more useful.
Or clowning.
Oh, trust me, I've been talking a lot.
Yeah.
Working in radio for 20 years like I did, 20 plus years that I did, I came out of it and was like, I have no other skills. I don't know how to work in an office. I don't know what an Excel spreadsheet is.
So that's what I was talking about. When you have no marketable skill and you're not so old to know the facts of life that you can't make a living at this, you know, it's kind of, well, actually, your podcast is called What's Your Real Job?
Maybe so what do you really do?
I might be on the wrong podcast because this has been my real job, although it's not. I don't depend on it like I once did, but I had some really good years and, you know.
Well, what made you get into busking? Because, I mean, as a comedian, I can't really, you know, pontificate on a street corner and hope people are going to throw me by.
It's harder. Jimmy Tingle did a little bit, but he, you need to have a gimmick. And Jimmy Tingle had the harmonica.
Yeah, Jimmy Tingle, who's a local Boston comedian and political advocate or former political aspiree.
So we both worked Harvard Square back in the day. Him a little before me. But he had the harmonica and he brought it again. But the guy, by the way, has a heart of gold and really cares about the country and activism. And so we did a fundraiser for Kamala and also for the Movement Voter Project, which is better than giving, my opinion, than giving the Democratic Party because they are so lean and mean and wonderful. But he was a fantastic MC, and I might be diverging a bit, but his gimmick was the harmonica, and he brought it back all these decades later, and it still killed. And he calls that evergreen material because a lot of comics use topical material. You might be making fun of a commercial or whatever. He said that's material that is so old, but it's always green.
Yeah, making fun of politicians for being greedy and racist is also evergreen.
Well, it's the method, yes. But the actual jokes. Actually, I got one joke in my thing. I puff my cheeks out and I hold my fingers like this and people still laugh. I'm wondering how long is that going to get that Nixon reference, you know?
Right. How much longer is that Nixon going
to be? I thought the answer was it's way too old, but.
What is what does a young Alex Feldman on the streets of San Francisco busking act look like?
I'm not going to tell you. I think one of these days I might be able to calmly watch some of those things if they exist. But, you know, I think it's also because of the prejudice. Like, I really want to work in, you know, in this country, I work more family audiences when I do theaters. But other countries I can work, they don't have this prejudice. But the whole point is a busker is just the last thing they want because the perception among the bookers is that why would audiences want to pay for tickets when they can get it for free on the streets? And I'm even I'm actually now see it from their point of view because I'm putting together a variety show and a couple of the acts are among the best street performers in the country. And by the way, if you're really good on the streets, you learn lessons that are so adaptable because it's one of the hardest places to work. But I don't want audiences I don't talk about that. I talk about how they did so well at America's Got Talent because that will impress the American public.
And draw them in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's also, that's a hard thing in comedy is talking about the credits. You know, there's certain things that we as comedians think is prestigious. And then there's other time where you have to say, was seen on NBC.
Right.
I was like, oh.
Even if it NBC, was just your hand as a hand model or something, you know, they often hire people like us to be hand models because, you know, we can manipulate things good. But yeah, that's more impressive. Getting your hand in a Super Bowl commercial for half a second is more impressive than having a 1-hour show off Broadway. I did a off Broadway show, but it meant nothing to people.
Yeah. So what? I'm curious as to, you weren't born and raised in Massachusetts, were you?
I was born in Utica, New York, but I would say I grew up, most of my life I've been in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I'm just realizing now through our conversation, I assumed you were born and raised Somerville, but I realized that you weren't, and then you spent most of your, you know, post-college adult life here, right?
Yes.
What brought you from San Francisco to Boston?
No, my mother wasn't well, and she asked me to come back, and then I did. And I had no idea that she had one more year to live. She didn't herself. She died very suddenly at 47. But she said, come home. And actually, I was really on the fence on that. I could have lived. I might have had a whole different career out there. For better or for worse. You know what? I don't think it would have been better because I'm really happy with my family and I'm here and I have a good life here. But yeah, that's why.
Okay. So I can empathize with that because I stayed in Baltimore until my 30s when my father is sick and I need to be here to help him and my mother. Because my older brother went to college in Philly and then left us. And I just said this recently on another episode talking about the day my father died is the day I got the email about my job in Boston. Like, and there's no more evidence of destiny. It's getting a phone call from my sister going, Dad's dead. I'll be right there. As I'm hailing a cab in the snow the day after Christmas, I get an email going, hey, I got your application. We have a position open here in Boston. I talked to your friend Jackson. We would love to have you up here in Boston. Call me when you have a chance. Like, we're talking about the difference of minutes.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, and I can understand that wanting to deal, you know, be close to your family.
You know, there was a powerful lesson I learned. Like, she died suddenly at 47. I was going to get, my very first big piece of publicity was in Boston Magazine. She died in December, and it was the February issue, which was going to come out in early in January. That, you know, so it looks current. And I had a one-page spread. I was very excited about it, but I didn't tell my parents because I knew they'd subscribe to Boston Magazine. I thought I would just wait and wait, and eventually they would open the magazine and see it. And then I think the other part of me is I didn't want to jinx it. Like when they first called me and interviewed you, that's a good time to tell people. In my thinking then was don't jinx it. But now I've learned that if you've got good news, tell people, even if it's not sure it's going to happen, because they like to hear it. And by the way, it's kind of cool to hear about something before it happens. And if it doesn't happen, people aren't going to go, hey, what about, you said this was going to, and you're full of shit, you know? So it really made an impact on me that don't keep to yourself, you know, nice things, you know, and because you'd want to hear nice things from the people you care about.
That's a good lesson learned. Don't, you know, share your, and sometimes we as performers don't want to talk about the good things happening because it feels like we're being braggadocious.
That's another thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is, people want to share in your joy, and that's something you don't want to deny people of, because you also, you know, in both our scenarios, we don't know when somebody's not going to be there to share in your joy.
Yeah. I mean, some of us are okay with sharing on social media, but some of us have a lot of trouble with that point too, but it doesn't seem, I mean, I still struggle with that, but I usually don't regret sharing and I got to get over myself, and I struggle with that, but it's, I don't struggle telling other people or telling my kids, hell, you gotta tell the world what you're doing. They actually like it too.
Like the act, when did it develop into a silent clown act?
Oh, that was a specific thing. I got kind of lucky when Just for Laughs called me.
Which is a very prestigious comedy festival in Montreal, Canada.
Yeah. Although it wasn't the hugest part. They have two sections. I got the smaller French section calling. And I'm not sure why.
Silent act works in French and English, so there's your benefit.
Well, they said, back then I had a talking act. And they said, can you do it without talking? Because it's, or talk in French. Or they said, can you do it in French? That's what they said. Can you do it in French? And I went, oui. Bien sûr. I took
a, that's the thing about Hollywood. It's whatever they ask you, it's always a yes. Can you ride a horse? I got a saddle in the trunk.
If people listen to your podcast, learn one thing. That is such an important lesson. Say yes. We had a great Somerville TED Talk, and it was all about saying yes. So anyway, when they said, can you do it in French? I said, oui, yes. And then I proceeded to hire a tutor and translate my act into French. And as the date got closer and closer, I realized I wasn't learning as fast as I could. And, you know, translating comedy is a little bit hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so my backup plan was French gibberish. So, boom. Bon ben, Denis, couple France un petit peu, yeah, you know, and so that was, I played around with that, and so I did the French act the first day, which went horrible. I did the second act. I did the gibberish, which was not quite as horrible because I mean, that took a lot of years to work on, but there was something that very day that I did the gibberish, even though I wasn't getting the laughs I was hoping for getting. I saw that they looked at me completely different. Well, basically, they looked at me the whole time. I mean, when you're doing word comedy, they can take their eyes off you for a second, but they couldn't if it's visual. And so I could feel that connection. And then the progression was very rapid, and was rapid and slow at the same time. I was doing all kinds of random sounds, and I learned to refine them into a language. But I could definitely feel an energy. And then I went back to Just for Laughs with that French gibberish act. And it was all, and then it became a thing that I got, from that, I got acts in other countries, and I adapted my gibberish to sort of slowly adapt to the country. And then I said, it'd be less work if I tried to create a gibberish language that I didn't have to relearn every country I went to.
Mm. Now, Was there some sort of precedence for this gibberish?
Oh, yes, there was. And then also, I've also enjoyed creating a legend around it, because I also, for a while, would do schools, and they would often hire me for a medieval program. I talked about how medieval jesters would go from town to town, and each town had a different dialect or a whole different language, and that helped. And then also they could say things that maybe would make fun of the king or queen or the censor, and the censors wouldn't catch it. I didn't say booga baga slotty. I said booga baga sludu. And that was mostly true, but then I filled in the details because there wasn't a, people didn't really quote medieval gestures in written language too much, but there was a little bit. So it was really fun taking facts and then also fleshing out conjecture to create backwards history.
Hmm. That's interesting that, you know, that you find the history of a certain performing style and then kind of recreate the mythology of it behind it.
Yes, that's the word. Recreate the mythology behind it. And it was kind of weird because I would do question and answer. And it was a real mix of using the facts I knew and then doing a little, it's sort of like painting what a dinosaur looks like.
Yeah, painting what we think it looks like based on the information we have that is incomplete.
And then using artistic license.
Hmm, that's fascinating.
Speaking of which, I heard that the Diplodocus is conjectured to have had such a long, skinny tail that it could crack the tail like a whip.
Yeah, I've heard that. Well, my favorite dinosaur fact for my tours is the Museum of Science, in Cambridge and Boston here, has a T-Rex dinosaur on the outside of the building and a T-Rex on the inside, and they have the sign showing you the difference.
Oh, my God. I know just what you're talking about. Yeah.
Difference, yeah.
And the dinosaur on the outside is erect.
Yeah, and the one in the base or in the lower level is facing forward, and I talk about that on the tour because I read that right there on the thing of it. That's the difference in 50 years of archaeological discovery, is that
right.
When we made that one in the 1960s, there had only been 5 partial T-Rex skeletons found in the world, which, you know, I'm grew up in, you know, born in 81, grew up through the 80s and 90s, and to me, that's what dinosaurs were. It wasn't until almost the 2000s right. that we realized what T-Rex looked like and that they were leaning forward and their arms are in different positions and stuff. And it's like, we all agreed that T-Rexes looked like this.
I love that.
Become, you know, it's like taking Pluto away as the planet. And
I
just
was just
going
to say that because I love to say Pluto is not a planet. Just because I know I'm going to start a fight. good fight.
Pluto is not a planet, is the pineapple of pizza of the scientific world.
Well, but I think it also does, like, I don't like to argue for the sake of arguing, but in that one case, I am arguing for the sake of arguing because it illustrates the same thing you said about the dinosaurs, that we keep reevaluating, and the kind of people I like to hang around with don't hold on to their opinion so strongly. New data keeps coming up. And it takes a little effort to not hold your opinion strongly, but it is so worth it. And it's the company I like to keep. And it also, I think it keeps you feeling younger too. You know, that you're just, you're realizing that T-Rex, we still might see a different posture on that T-Rex, you know? Maybe it's going to have little angel wings. I mean, they keep thinking that there's feathers on them, and maybe that T-Rex would have, you know, or maybe
they recently just discovered what animals, what dinosaurs, you know, noise they made. You know, they didn't make a roar noise. They go like almost like a chicken noise.
It is amazing.
You know,
and it also reminds me of genetics.
A few years ago,
we're learning so much.
Speaking of discovering new things about themselves, how did the act evolve over the years? Because we talked earlier about the act, you know, you have a lot of disciplines in juggling and balancing act and unicycle and stage magic. Where was the impetus for the creating new bits to add to the act over the years? What was the catalyst for you?
So when I tried all kinds of things, lots of different skills, and then started dropping them year after year. I dropped them because they weren't consistent. Like, for example, when I started concentrating on being a medieval jester, I got rid of the unicycles. I also had a pogo stick. I made the pogo stick out of wood and leather. it didn't go very high, but it was a medieval pogo stick. But then that got too heavy. I started to fly to more gigs, and so I tried to make the act lighter. And so I would look at props of how much does this weigh versus how many minutes of stage time I get on it. And depending if it was a good ratio, it stayed in the act. A bad ratio, I'd get rid of the heavy thing. So I was going through, and I remember when you could fly international, 100-pound bag, two of them. Then it became 70, and now it's 50. And that really influenced the act. I also wanted things to fit inside my cart. So there were constraints. And sometimes I used to think, God, these constraints are making it harder. But then I realized they're not. They're actually, it makes you work a little harder. But look what Shakespeare did with a sonnet that they have. How many lines? Like 15 lines, iambic pentameter, all these rules, and yet some really wonderful stuff. So some constraints, while they might be a little bit taxing, really help create. So the development of the act got rid of the big props, then the medium props. And then I also didn't want to sweat on stage. Not because, and I don't have a problem with sweating, by the way. I sweat less than most. But it was the latest metric. I mean, the first metric of how I was doing was, are the people still watching me at the end of the show? It was that low of a bar because I sucked when I started. Well, it's pretty hard to do an outdoor show and be good the first time. So I wanted to keep them. And then when I was able to hold a crowd, it was how much of the laughs can be from jokes that are not stock material. You know what I mean by that? You know, the trade. And then
street jokes.
Filter. And then it had to be material.
Low hanging fruit.
Right. Then it had to be material that was, as you would say, true to the voice. And then I did want to have less props. And then the gibberish really, I mean, was transformative. Because when you create your, I mean, there's a tradition of gibberish language, but I don't think any two gibberish speakers do it the same way. So when you're making up your own language, that really just gives you new soil to plant bits. And then the other thing that got really interesting was shortening it. I just really like shortening it. And doing stand-up comedy really encourages you to compress. And then now I'm taking away bits that get laughter just because they might be interfering with an arc that I'm trying to do. I mean, I used to do a lot more.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen my act, but I used to like serenade someone, play Greensleeves. I'd cry when she wouldn't blow me a kiss, and I'd be, next thing you know, I'm crying and the flute's in my nose. I can go 5 minutes there. I might do it again, but I took that out recently just because I wanted to have an arc and get to the, and whatever. So those are the development.
You're
and
building it's still not- towards something. Yeah. I mean, as a narrative-based comedian that I am, I have to work with those constraints as well as where, hey, I got a bunch of really good jokes here, but this joke doesn't progress the narrative that I'm creating. So I have to get rid of it, you know, in theory, or find a way to make it work. It's that.
That's right.
That, you know, some people want to think that constraints are limiting, but they're not.
Right.
They are influential.
And if you're going to be able, if you're going to do that and get rid of those things, especially, you know, rework it, even though it's already getting some laughs. This is why, as frustrating as political correctness can be on comedians, I think bitch about it over the bar for the night and then forget about it because stop. Otherwise, you're whining. The people don't, they can't take a joke. I mean, I think it is a problem that people get so outraged so easily. But what's the point of bitching about it? Because they are what they are. Times change. If you have the audacity to create this act and you practice it the way you practice it, you should be able to find a way to not upset this group of people. I mean, if you're big and famous, you can have your cult following that will follow you no matter what you do. But for us working class people who are just middle class and trying to get by, you know, don't bitch about people taking offense so easily. And they do.
Yeah.
They do, but it's,
well, there's a line between, you know, finding your audience and also entertaining the audience that's in front of you.
Yeah. Maybe it's, and then you're right. And then I love the perfect dance is when you're entertaining the audience in front of you, but you didn't go all the way to meet them. You found some place where they had, like when I come on and I'm doing gibberish, that first minute is a very tough minute because they're going, what the fuck, you know, it's like, I'm still working.
What did I sign up for?
Right. I'm still working on that. You know, I mean, some of it might look pretty rehearsed, and it is, but I'm still keep redoing the beginning because it's a real. They're not expecting gibberish, you know, when they want to come on. By the way, I have been a bit of an anomaly at the comedy studio, but I'm bringing on a whole crew of people who are not the typical stand-ups. And
I'm excited to see that.
Yeah. I am too. And I'm now realizing that it's different. I mean, I think I'm not worried about the entertainment value, but I have to prepare the club that, you know, that little dressing room that's collecting more and more stuff in it and is now one third the size it once was. That's okay for comedians. I mean, remember the comedy studio back when it was at the Hong Kong and you're in that little super skinny closet with holes in the walls? You couldn't even
where they keep
someone.
The chairs at night.
Yeah, you'd be like, remember? Yeah, so we're used to that, but yeah, like I have a contortionist who's fantastic, but she's got to stretch on a yoga mat before she goes on, you know. But anyway, those are just details. I'm real excited that we're going to bring a really. I mean, it's called Varieté because this is big in Germany and France. It's variety, but variety in America is just waking up again, whereas it never went to sleep in Europe. And they've had variety theaters where adults go and have a good cocktail and will watch one after another of these short, fast-paced acts that are really different from each other, whether it's a contortionist or ventriloquist or a magician or a lot of comedy jugglers or acrobats the kind of stuff that Ed Sullivan would present, and hopefully that will come back here. I mean, it already is in Chicago, in Seattle. There are dinner theaters that do that, but there's nothing in Boston right now. So
and a lot of the Ren fairs too.
Well, right, that's right. They do it, and I will be. I plan to be booking some of those performers who will be excited to get away from the dust and the competing noise of a Ren fair.
Yeah, the outdoors.
It's a lot of competition.
Climbing inside.
And they're good. You get really good if you can survive that. You probably got really good from doing duck tours. When you're in less than ideal conditions, you're doing a lot of bicep curls.
Well, I'm excited by it because I will tell you the best show I probably have ever saw was a beer promotion. A bunch of years back, there was, you know, Dos Equis.
Yeah.
Their tagline was, you know, the most interesting man in the world. That was their character, where they think that they revolved their commercials around. And they did a U.S. variety show tour called The Most Interesting Tour in the World. And the reason I went is because it was hosted by one of my favorite musicians. It was emceed by Angelo Moore from the band Fishbone. And I discovered an amazing juggler, comedian guy who, you know, Mark the Knife Fay.
Oh, calls yeah. Himself yeah. He's great. Yeah. Most, he's done yeah, those type of things.
The most dangerous comedian. And they did this. They had the human slinky, they had knife throwing, they had music acts. And I always wanted to recreate that kind of show where they had these amazingly crazy and different performers and put that in a space intertwined with comedians and other, you know, for lack of a better term, circus, sideshow act performers and trying to do that show. And it sounds like you're creating what my dream is. So I can't wait.
Oh,
I'm so
man.
Excited to see it and I want it to work out.
Well, I'll be back in touch with you because you're very good at promoting things you like, you know, and you got energy on that, and you're very generous that way. So, yeah, I'll keep you very much in the loop.
Well, I'm excited to see it, but also excited to talk to you about our final thing we'll talk about before we get out of here.
When can you see that show? By the way, is it November 24th?
You did the plug for me. I was going to do the plug later. Actually, I didn't know the date off the top of my head, and I'm going to get this out before that. So, yes, if you are in the Boston.
I couldn't remember. I was looking at your face to help me remember.
But let's get the last thing I want to talk to you about is because I want to hear your side of this, because, you know, we've been talking a lot about my tour, and you are part of my tour.
Of your tour?
I think I told you this. My duck tour, you are part of it, in that when I talk about the Boston Marathon, I talk about that you are the first and probably only person to finish the Boston Marathon on a unicycle back in 1984.
Ah. Wow.
Which I learned from you posting about on Facebook. And I'm like, oh, you know, I read the Boston Globe article about it back in the day. And I tell people on the tour about it, and you're a clown. You're an amazing performer. So why did you do the Boston Marathon on a unicycle?
I was into mischief. In fact, I missed that. You know, I got thrown off of it two times by the police.
Really?
Yeah.
During that one tour or that run?
Yeah, it was 26 miles.
The thing about it is you weren't an official competitor to the Boston Marathon. You have to qualify for it.
I put what I thought looked official. I put the a tag that said, "You won." By the way, I overdressed for that. Until you unicycle 26 miles, you don't realize how much heat you're going to generate. And it was a very cold, wet day. But when I finished, I was cold and even. No, I wasn't cold. I was hot and wet. Yeah. Yeah. But it was because they have it, you know, in early April, and it was a raw day. But anyway, people now can do that easier because they've now built bigger wheels. I'm like to be remembered that I did that with a small wheel. It was a little 24-inch wheel.
24-inch wheel?
Oh, yeah, now on the internet, they have unicycle factories that make all kinds of different sizes. And it's the internet's really helped, you know.
Because the article I read was you were talking about doing it. So you basically announced you're going to do it and then had to hold yourself to doing it. Was there anything behind the wanting to do it as other than I'm going to see if I can do it? Oh, wouldn't it be funny if I did this?
Yeah, wouldn't it be funny? Yeah, I thought so. I thought having that U on and crossing and also I kind of like, it was a great way to do something that was kind of athletic without having to do the grueling training of actually running it. But to the novice, I think it looks just as impressive, if not more. But even though I didn't have to train as hard as someone who really ran the whole thing, you know.
Is there any way you know how long it took you to do the Boston Marathon on a unicycle?
Oh, well, yeah, I timed it. It was 3 hours and 14 minutes.
Shut up. 3 hours and 14 minutes?
Mm-hmm. And now, if you got a big wheel, you could do it a lot faster. But like I said, my feet were, I don't know if you can see it, I was going like this on the little wheel. Boy, I had this inner.
Well, to qualify for the Boston Marathon, you have to do a marathon in 3 hours, 30 minutes for a man your age on foot.
Right.
Well, so that's
back then I wasn't a man of my age. I would have had to do it in the competitive zone. But yeah, mm-hmm. If I did that today, yeah.
Would you, there's a lot more openness to it. Like there's a cycle part of the Boston Marathon.
There'll be way more. The audience quite liked it. I call them the audience. I guess in sports you call them the fans, you know, but they were good. I mean, now that there's all kinds of people who wear funny heads and guy wears a cow head and everything. There was a little of that then, but not as much. And so, I mean, only a few years before they had no women. I think women just had come in.
1972.
It was run by the BAA was conservative. That's probably why the police threw me off.
Oh, I talk about Catherine Switzer too, who was the first official woman to run. Other women tried running it before, unofficially.
Right.
Much like you. They jumped over a fence and they ran until someone gave up chasing them.
But yes.
Catherine Switzer was almost tackled.
It was more like original, that. I was the
guy in charge of it.
Yeah. So yes, you're empathizing with back in those days, it was hard ass.
Is there any thought of trying it again? Since it's probably more acceptable now?
Well, kind of did that. And also now there's so much bigger wheels that they go a lot. As far as stunts, I mean, I'm into two wheels now. I really love to bicycle, and I'm going. In fact, that's the one area of risk which I'm still not really managing as well as I could, because I like to ride with other riders and go fast, and I'm not patient going through traffic. I'm a little too aggressive, and I've fallen a couple times this year, and I think they make the pavement harder than they used to. So, I think that's probably the biggest risk in my life is my interest in fast cycling through the city. I got to dial that. Yeah, I think that's a sort of been a theme of today is risk management.
You know? All right. Well, Alex, it was great hearing about your history, getting into clowning and getting into performing and entertaining and being able to relate one-on-one with the struggles of both of our different styles of art form that makes us both individuals, but also bring us together. And of course, people can see you and more variety shows at Variété at the Comedy Studio on Sunday, November 24th at 7 p.m.
Yeah, we'll have some really
tickets.
Great,
you can get tickets at thecomedystudio.com.
And now, having this little visit with you, I now get that you're one of us as far as the misfit alternative. And the fact that you love that beer tour that showed all those, that you wanted to do that, I'm like, ah, that's why we've been saying, hey, how you doing all these years? Yeah.
Awesome. Alex, and then other than the Variety show, where else can people learn more about Alex the Jester?
Oh, well, there's alexthejester.com, although I'm now doing livealex.com is more what I'm doing today. And I have a TED talk on that one, but either one of those websites, you can find out more. And I'm on Facebook. I'm Alex the Jester.
Thanks for coming on the program and sharing your story with us.
Well, keep doing what you're doing and bringing audiences to appreciate this alternative universe.
Time.